past. One possible way of couching it is to choose to say that we will take apart your skull very gently and reconstruct a skull for you that will have a highly developed bump of clarity and a slight concave dent where the fear instinct used to be. I'm doing my best to cast all this in terms that you are right now, can be comfortable with, Tina. Though I need to tell you, I feel uncomfortable adjusting a presentation toward or down toward anyone in any way, since I'm terribly vain, both as a man and an educator, about my reputation for candor, Tavis said, the audible smile. It is one of my limitations. Stice withdrew without even having to say goodbye to Hal. They were at complete ease with one another. It had been a bit different the year before, when Hal was still in boys' 16s. Hal heard Stice say something to somebody out in the lobby. Part of CT's impression of distance, just past the eye's focal length, was the fact that the two sides of his face didn't quite go together. It wasn't as drastic as a stroke victim's face, or a deformity. The subtlety of it was part of it, the essential vagueness about himself that Tavis fought by sort of peeling his skull back and exposing his brain to you without any sort of warning or invitation. It was part of the man's preoccupied frenzy. Between Orthostice's exit and the mom's entry, Hal had been flexing the ankle and watching the swelling shift slightly under the multiple socks. He stood and put his weight on the ankle experimentally a couple times, and then sat back down and flexed it, watching the swelling very intently. The way he knew suddenly that he was going to go down and get high in secret in the pump room before showering was that it hadn't occurred to him to ask the darkness about making some sort of arrangements to eat together, since Stice had missed supper too. His viscera were putting out the sound of one of those tea kettles that doesn't have a whistle and so just rumbles as it boils. A competitive athlete cannot skip meals without terrific metabolic distress. After a little while, Avril Incandenza, ETA's Dean of Academic Affairs, had lowered her head under the waiting room's jam and come in, looking fresh and totally untouched by the heat. She had one of the orientation packets in its customary red and gray binder. The mom's always had this way of establishing herself in the exact center of any room she was in, so that from any angle, she was somehow in the line of all sight. It was part of her, and so, to that extent, dear to Hal. But it was noticeable, and kind of unsettling. His brother Oren, during a late-night round of family trivia, had once described Avril as the black hole of human attention. Hal had been pacing, rising up on the toes of the left foot, trying to gauge the exact level of physical discomfort he was feeling. That's when she came in. Hal and the moms always greeted each other, kind of extravagantly. When Avril entered a room, any sort of pacing reduced to orbiting, and Hal's pacing became vaguely circular around the waiting room's perimeter, as Avril rested her tailbone on the receptionist's desk and crossed her ankles and produced her cigarette case. Her manner always became very casual and almost sort of male when she and Hal were alone in a room. She watched him walk. The ankle? He hated himself for exaggerating the limp even slightly. Tender. Sore at the very worst. More like tender. No, now, no need to cry, C.T. was exclaiming as he knelt at the side of the chair from which little legs dangled and were spasming around. I didn't mean literally break as in break open your head, Tina. Please let me acknowledge that this is totally my fault, my dear, for presenting what we'll be up to here in just exactly the wrong sort of light. Avril had casually produced a 100-millimeter Rodney from the flat brass case and tamped it on an unlined knuckle. Hal produced no lighter. Neither of them had looked toward Tavis's office's mall. Avril's smock-type dress was blue cotton, with a kind of scalloped white doily around the shoulders, and white stockings and painfully white Reebok cross-trainers. "I am horrified that I've made you cry like this," Tavis's voice had assumed that stressed character of issuing from the end of a long corridor. "Just please know that a totally unthreatening lap is available if you want a lap, is all I can think of to say." Avril always smoked with her smoking arm up, an elbow resting in the crook of the other arm. She would frequently hold a Rodney just this same way, without lighting it or even putting it in her mouth. She permitted herself to smoke only in her ETA office and headmaster's house study, and one or two other venues outfitted with air filtration equipment. Her posture that night, with her coccyx against something and looking down the length of her legs, was awfully close to the way himself used to stand around. She indicated CT's door with her head. "I gather he's been in there a while?" Hal despised even the very slight suggestion of whine that came in. "I've been waiting here, coming up on an hour." And that he liked it a little, that she looked pained for him, as her tiny eyebrows, unplucked, just naturally tiny and arched, went up.
"You've had nothing to eat then yet?"
"I was summoned." Tavis's voice in there.
"I'll invite you right here and now to sit on my lap and let me make such soothing sounds as, there, there, there."
"Want my mommy and daddy?"
Avril said.
"That's the old tum making those sounds then, and not the air conditioner?"
With that smile that was also a kind of wince.
"Couldn't even start to describe the sounds coming from down there. Like that whistleless kettle himself used to leave on when..."
An apple appeared from a deep pocket in her smock.
"Happen to have a spare Granny Smith here. Attack body to soul while we wait."
He smiled tiredly at the big green apple.
"Mom's, that's your apple. That's all you're going to eat between 12 and 23, I happen to know."
Avril made a distended gesture.
"Stuffed. Huge lunch with a set of parents not 3 hours ago. I've been staggering around since."
Looking at the apple like she had no idea where it even come from.
"I'll probably pitch this out."
"You will not."
"Please."
Rising from the desk's edge, without seeming to use muscles, apple held out like something distasteful. Cigarette down at her side, where it would be putting a hole in the smock if lit.
"You'd be doing both of us a favor."
"This drives me bats. You know this drives me bats."
Oren and Hal's term for this routine is politeness roulette. This mom's thing that makes you hate yourself for telling her the truth about any kind of problem because of what the consequences will be for her. It's like to report any sort of need or problem is to mug her. Oren and Hal had this bit during family trivia sometimes.
"Please, I'm not using this oxygen anyway."
"What? This old limb?
Take it.
In the way all the time. Take it."
"But it's a gorgeous bowel movement, Mario. The living room rug needed something. I didn't know what till right this very moment."
The special fantoddish chill of feeling both complicit and obliged. Hal despised the way he always reacted, taking the apple, pretending to pretend his reluctance to eat her supper was a pretense. Oren believed she did it all on purpose, which was way too easy. He said she went around with her feelings out in front of her with an arm around the feelings windpipe and a Glock 9mm to the feelings temple, like a terrorist with a hostage daring you to shoot. The moms held the red binder out to Hal without moving.
"Have you seen Alice's new packets?"
The apple was good sour, but perfumey from the pocket of the moms' smock, and it stimulated a torrent of saliva. The binder had different little informal and action photos from the waiting room walls, and off-prints of clippings, and three rings with a packet of guidelines and honor code pledges, all done up by Moore in a gothic italics. Hal looked up from the binder, indicating CT's office with his head. "You're taking the girl around yourself?"
"We're encouragingly short-staffed. Thierry and Donnie won their qualifying round at Hartford, so they're staying over."
She leaned way forward and looked in at CT, so he could see she was out here. She smiled.
Hal followed her look. The girl's name's Tina something, and she'll come up to about your knee.
Echt, Avril said, looking at something on a printout.
Hal looked at her while he chewed.
You don't like her already?
Tina Echt, Paul Tuckett. Father, apparently some sort of unleavened baker. Mother, a public relations person for the Red Sox AAA baseball there.
Hal had to wipe his chin as he smiled.
Triple A, not AAA.
Avril was leaning forward at the waist with the binder, to her breast the way females hold flat things, still trying to catch the headmaster's eye.
Hal said, Trolch finally has some competition in the repulsive last name department.
Lord, she is a small one, isn't she?
I can't see her being more than maybe 5.
Oh, golly, let's see. 8'7", high IQ, somewhat impoverished-looking MMPI. Played out of Providence Racket and Bath in East Providence. Ranked 31st in Eastern 12s as of June.
She can't be much taller than her damn stick out there when she plays. Shit's gonna keep her here, what, 12 years?
The girl's father has been calling about admission for her for over 2 years, Charles said.
He was doing that thing about taking skulls apart, and she yelled bloody murder.
Avril's laugh's onset was high-pitched and alarming and distinctive. So now at least CT would for sure know the moms was out here waiting, and would wind things up and maybe get to Hal so Hal could go get high in secret.
Well, good for her,
Avril said.
The orbit took him around lateral Alice Moore's desk in a kind of thick ellipse. Every time his left foot came down, he either dipped down or raised up briefly to tiptoe, flexing the ankle.
10 years here and she'll lose her mind. If she starts at 7, she'll either be ready for the show at 14, or by 14 she'll start getting that burned-out look that makes you want to wave your hand in front of her face.
There was the sound of Tavis's squeaky right nun bush pacing faster, which meant real conclusion.
I'm going to predict it's probably hard to see yourself as a great athlete at this stage, Tina. Not being able to see over the net yet. But possibly even harder to see yourself as providing entertainment, engaging people's attention. As a high-velocity object people can project themselves onto. Forgetting their own limitations in the face of the nearly limitless potential someone as young as yourself represents.
The apple generated tremendous amounts of saliva.
He'll put her in the show before Menses. There'll be another enormous fuss and high rental cartridges of a girl no larger than a racket beating up on hairy Slavic lesbians. And then by 14 she'll be like old coal in the bottom of a backyard grill.
Some old military joke about apples kept running through. Eat the apple, fuck the core. Hal couldn't remember what it was supposed to signify. The moms was snapping her fingers silently and working her forehead.
There's some term for coals reduced to residue after a day in a grill. I'm trying to think.
Hal hates this.
Clinkers, he said instantly. From clinker, Low German, and clinkered, Old Dutch. To sound, ring. Nominated to substantive around 1769. A hard mass formed by the fusion of the earthy impurities of like coal, iron ore, limestone.
He hated it that she could even dream he'd been taken in by the aphasic furrowing and finger snapping, and then that he's always so pleased to play along. Is it showing off if you hate it?
Clinker.
A grill wouldn't have clinkers. Charcoal's refined to burn right down to dust. Clinkers are sort of metallic, I think. See, for example, the ring dash sound etymology. I like to suspect this is why so many of our older players like to project me into this carnival barker persona, with tiny balance sheets revolving in my eyes, that I'm up front with every incoming addition to our family, that this is where the resources come from for professional tennis. And for the North American Junior Development System for gifted children who want to scale the heights to professionalism or to a competitive college career. And so ultimately for an academy like this one's considerable operating expenses and for scholarships like the partial one we're so happy to be able to offer your parents for you.
So then perhaps you'd care to join us for dinner. We're also having Ms. Act if she can stay up that long.
The core made a very muffled cymbal sound in the bottom of lateral Alice's wastebasket.
I can't get out of Dawn's. Wayne and I are supposed to play Slobodan and Hardigan at some corporate spectacle thing at Auburndale right after lunch.
221.
Have you had Barry speak to Gerhardt about the ankle not getting better?
The clay will be good to it. Shit knows all about the ankle.
Well, best of British luck to you both.
Avril's purse looked more like soft luggage than like a purse.
May I lend you the key to the kitchen, then?
It's always the mom's left shoulder, Hal looks over, whenever he orbits. And his plans emerged between Avril's invitations to accept some sort of politeness act. The darkness and I were going to blast down the hill and grab something if and when I ever get out of here.
Oh.
Then he wondered with dread what Stice might have said to her on her way in regarding supper.
Maybe Pemulus, too. I think Pemulus said.
Well, do not, under any circumstances, enjoy yourself.
Ect and Tavis were both standing now, in there. Their handshake looked, for the first split second he looked, like C.T. was jacking off, and the little girl was going, Sieg Heil. Hal thought he was maybe starting to lose his mind. Even the meat of the Granny Smith smelled like perfume. 3 months later, earlier today, before being again summoned, at the dentist's. The dentist's office, it had a weird, sharp, clean, sweet smell about it, the olfactory equivalent of fluorescent light. Hal had felt the cold stab in the gum, and then the slow radial freeze, his face ballooning to become one of the frozen cumuli against the aftershave blue of the dental wallpaper sky. Zagarelli, DDS, had dry, dark green eyes that bulged above his mint-blue mask, as in like olives where his eyes should be, as he leaned in to proceed, his dental overhead lights corona giving him one of those mal-perspectived medieval halos that seemed to stand on end. Even masked, Zagarelli's breath was infamous. ETAs forced for the first time by their ETA group plan to recline below Zagarelli are counseled on how to respire. To inhale when Zagarelli inhales, and exhale right back out with him, to avoid doubling the amount of suffering Hal's already gone through, just today. Charles Tavis is not a buffoon. The thing that's keeping things so tensely quiet out here amid all this waiting room blue is that there are historically at least two Charles Tavises, the three older boys know. The openly cross-sectional and free-associating and arms-waving on the perspectival horizon, dithering, hand-wringing, total-worry persona is really Tavis's version of social composure, his way of trying to get along with you. But just ask Michael Pemulus, whose sneakers have been on Tavis's carpet so often, they've left an unvacuumable impression in the checked antron. When Tavis loses his composure, when the integrity or smooth function of the academy or his unquestioned place at the ETA tiller is, God forbid, threatened, Hal's openly adjustable uncle becomes a different man, one not to be fucked with. It's not necessarily pejorative to compare a cornered bureaucrat to a cornered rat. The danger sign to watch out for is if Tavis suddenly gets very quiet and very still. Because then he seems, prospectively, to grow. He seems, sitting there, to rush in at you, dopplering in at a whisper. Almost looming over you from across the huge desk. If shit meets administrative fan, kids coming out of his mandible-doored office come out pale and rubbing their eyes, not from tears, but from this depth perspective skewing that CT suddenly affects when there's shit. Another alert is when lateral Alice Moore gets formally buzzed to bring you and the others in, instead of the office doors ever opening from inside, and when she gets up and edges over to show you in, like you're some sort of hat-holding salesman, without once meeting your eye, as if they're shame. One big family. The diddle check seems like it's degenerated into the girls all getting very excited and exchanging data on what kinds of animals members of their own biologic families either imitate or physically resemble. And Avril's out of sight and silent and apparently letting them go with it for a while and vent stress. Hal keeps checking for jaw drool with the back of his hand. Pemulus, in a Cyrillic-lettered T-shirt, takes off the hat and looks around himself and makes reflexive tie-straightening movements, taking one last look at his lines on the printout, while Axford stands there needing three tries to work the outside door's knob. And Kittenplan, on the other hand, wears an expression of almost regal calm and precedes them through the inner door like someone stepping down off a dais. And it also seems somehow sinister that she's apparently been in here all this time, this Clinette person, one of the nine-month temps from down the hill, pretty-eyed and so black she's got a bluish cast, with hair ironed straight and then pinned up, and the standard ETA custodial teal-blue zip-uppable jumpsuit, emptying Tavis's personal brass waste baskets into her big cart with its gray canvas sides. The way she stares at a point just to the side of Hal's own stare, as she and her cart wait at CT's inner door for Hal and the others to be ushered sideways through by lateral Alice Moore. The cart, like poor Otis Lord's own game master's cart, has a crazy wheel, and clatters a bit, even buried in shag, trying to maneuver around Moore as she reverses back along the vestibule's wall. Neither Stitt nor DeLint is in here. But from the hiss of Pemulus's inhale, Hal can tell that Dr. Dolores Rusk is in the room, even before he takes his eyes from a CT who's sitting, pulsing with swollen proximity, in his seagrass swivel chair, and almost done coolly bending a giant paperclip into a sort of cardioid or else sloppy circle. Tavis's window-lit shadow now reaches all the way past the stair blaster to the red and gray fabric ottoman along the east wall, in which sits, sure enough, Rusk, her hose lattered and face betraying nothing. And then next to her is poor old Otis P. Lord, the Hitachi monitor still over his head like the sallet of some grotesque high-tech knight, slumped and with his sneakers pointing at each other in the blue and black shag, hands in his lap. Two crude eye holes cut into the black plastic casing of the monitor's base, Lord not meeting Pemulus's eye, and wicked hanging shards of glass from the screen he fell through, pointing, some nearly touching even, his slim neck and throat. So he has to hold his head very still, despite the heavings of his shallow chest, with the day shift ETA nurse standing behind him, and inclined over the back of the sofa to hold the monitor very carefully in place, the incline producing cleavage which Hal would gladly choose to be the sort of person not to note. Lord's eyes move to Hal and blink dolefully through the holes, and he can be heard sniffing moistly in there, complexly muffled. And Pemulus is just finishing moving his feet precisely into their familiar impressions in the office carpet, when C.T., seeming direly to rise from his chair without getting up, quietly asks the room's last occupant, the scrubbed young button-nosed urologist in an O.N.A.N.T.A. blazer, severely underdue at E.T.A., seated back in the shadow of the open inner door in the room's southeast corner, so he's hidden right behind them from the start, and there's the opportunity for this stagey, incriminating type whirl and kertwang face from Axford and Hal as they hear Charles Tavis addressing the urine expert behind them, asking him very quietly, please, to close both doors. Pre-dawn and dawn, the 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA, still.
You can't say it's only a U.S. thing, Steepley said again. I went through school when multiculturalism was inescapable. We read about the Japanese and Indonesians, for example, having a mythic figure. I forget its name. Oriental myth. It's a woman covered with long blonde hair, entirely. Her whole body with blonde down all over it. This type of passive temptation, part of it seems to include a felt lack, a perceived deprivation. Orientals are not bodily a hairy culture. These multicultural Oriental myths always had young Oriental men happening upon her by some body of water combing her body hair and singing, and they have sex with her. Apparently she's simply too exotic and intriguing or seductive to resist. Even the young Oriental men who know of the myths can't resist, according to the myths.
And are rendered paralyzed with stasis by this intimate act, Marat said.
When now he dreamt of his father, it was of the two skating, young Marat and M. Marat, at a Saramee Damhurst outdoor rink. M. Marat's breath visible, and his pacemaker a boxy bulge in his Brunswickian cardigan.
Killed outright, usually. The pleasure's too intense. No mortal can stand it. Kills him. M-O-R-T-S.
Marat sniffed.
The analogous part is how even the ones who know the pleasure of it will kill them. They go ahead anyway.
Marat coughed. Some of the insects flying had multiple pairs of wings, and were bioluminescent. They seemed very intent, flying past the outcropping and darting jaggedly off on a course on their way to something urgent. The sound of them, the insects, made Marat think of playing cards and the bicycle spokes of the bicycle of a boy with legs. Both men were silent. This is the time of false dawns. Venus moved east, away from them. The softest light imaginable seeped into the desert and spread into the strange tan vistas around them. Something heating, just below the ring of night. His blanket of the lap was covered in burrs and small spiked seeds of some species. The USA desert began to rustle with life, of which most remained hidden. In the American sky, the stars fluttering like banked flames above a low-resolution seepage of glow. But none of the pinkening of genuine dawn.
Both the USA Office of Unspecified Services and Les Assassins des Fauteuils Roulants looked forward to these meetings of Marat and Steepley. They accomplished little. It was their sixth or seventh meeting. Steepley had volunteered to be liaison with Marat's betrayal, despite language.
222.
AFR believed Marat functioned as a triple agent, pretending to betray his nation for his wife, memorizing every detail of the meetings with BSS. According to Steepley, Steepley's BSS superiors did not know that Fortier knew that Steepley knew he, Fortier, knew Marat was here. Steepley held this fact back from his superiors. It satisfied some USA desire to hold some small thing back from one's superiors, Marat felt. Unless Steepley was deceiving Marat about this, Marat did not know. M. Fortier did not know Marat had reached the internal choice, that he loved his skull-deprived and heart-defective wife, Gertrand Marat, more than he loved the separatist and anti-ONAN cause of the nation Quebec, making Marat no better than M. Rodney the God Tyne. If Fortier knew of this, he would understandably drive a railroad spike through Gertrand's boneless right eye, killing her and Marat both. The real Marat gestured outward at the glowing but unpink east.
A false dawn.
No, Steepley said.
But your own francophone myth of your Odalisque of Teresa.
L'Odalisque de Saint-Thérèse.
Marat rarely yielded to the temptation to correct Steepley, whose horrid pronunciation, and the syntax as well, Marat could never determine for sure either was or was not an intentional irritant, intended to discomfort Marat.
Steepley said, "The multicultural myth being that the Odalisque's so beautiful that mortal Quebecois eyes can't take it. Whoever looks at her turns into a diamond or gem." in most versions an opal. A Medusa in reverse, one might say. Both men, well-versed in this, mirthlessly laughed.
223.
Marat said, "The Greeks, they did not fear beauty. They feared ugliness. Hence, I think, beauty and pleasure. These were not fatal temptations for the Greek type." "Or like a combination of Medusa and Circe, your odalisk," said Steeply. He was smoking either his last or one of his purse's pack's last cigarettes. The American's habit to throw the butts off the outcropping had prevented Marat from counting the consumed butts. Marat knew that Steeply knew that filters of cigarettes did not biodegrade for the environment. The two men, by this juncture of time, each knew the other. A hidden bird twittered. "The Greek mythic personality. It had also pregnancy by rain and rape by foul." "And haven't we come a long way?" Steeply said, ironically. "This irony and contempt for selves. These also are part of your USA type's temptation, I think."
"Whereas your type's a man of only actions, ends," Steeply said, with, Marat could not tell, either irony or maybe not. The desert floor was brightening by imperceptible degrees, its surface the color of overtanned hide. A saguaro cactus reptile hued. Potentially young forms in down sleeping bags of coffinous shape were now discernible around the black remains of the night's bonfire. The air smelled of green wood, the tasteless odor of dust. The distant construction site's payloaders were urine-colored and appeared frozen in the middle of various actions. It was still chill. Marat's teeth had a palpable film on them of perhaps a paste of dust, especially the front teeth. No sun's top arc was appearing, and Marat could cast no shadow yet on the shale behind them. Remy Marat's resting pulse rate was very low. No legs to require blood from the heart. He very rarely felt phantom pains, and then only in the stump of the left. All AFRs have enormous arms, particularly upper arms. Marat was left-handed. Steeply manipulated his cigarette with his left hand, and used his right arm to cradle the left elbow. But Marat knew quite well that Steeply was right-handed. The little wens of his field persona's electrolysis were now brightly pink against the pallor of Steeply's face, which appeared both puffy and drawn. The cloudless sky above the east's mountains of Rincon Range was the faint, sick pink of an unhealed burn. The whole imperceptibly lightening scene of the vistas had a stillness about it that suggested photography. Marat had long ago placed his watch in his windbreaker's pocket to keep from continually checking. Steeply enjoyed imagining that his interface dictated its own period and time. Marat had chosen to indulge this. Marat realized about himself that some of his pretended sniffing was for the purpose of alerting Steeply to the breaking of a silence.
"You could seat yourself briefly if you have fatigue. The shoes straps?" He gestured slightly.
Steeply made a show of looking down and prodding at the tan stone's dust with the toes of his shoe.
"It looks like there might be things."
"I must soon leave." Marat's hand was imprinted with the texture of the Sterling's pebbled grip. "It has been good to be in the air for a night. Soon I must leave."
"Crawling around the skirt, it makes one sensitive about simply plopping down wherever you wish. Possibility of things growing up."
He looked up at Marat. He appeared sad.
"I'd never realized."
0450 hours, the 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, front office, Ennett House, DARH, Enfield, Massachusetts.
"Didn't know whether to shit or shout Dixie after it went off. And the look on his face.
One of the times for me was, I'm in some bar in Lowell with some guys I'm crewing around with,
And we were there with some other guys, just fucking loyal knuckleheads. You young drunks that are just getting to be your young working-type drunks that stop off after work for just a couple and don't make it home till closing. Just putting away boilermakers and playing darts and this and that. And this one guy on the crew starts making moves on this one guy's girl. This real ordinary-looking guy's in there with his girl. And one of our guys starts saying this and that to her, trying to pick her up. And the date got pissed off, you know? Who can blame him? And there was words exchanged, and so on and so forth. And we was all there with this first guy, in a, like, group. He was the one talking the shit to this guy's girl, but he was our boy, we're all in the crew, so we all crew up on this girl's date and push him around somewhat, you know how it is. Say he's talking shit to our boy, he gets a little bit of a beating, dope slaps, nothing like extreme or blood, and we kick his ass around a little bit and toss him out of the spa. And get this girl to drink Boilermakers with us. And the one guy that was making the moves on her in the first place, he gets her to start playing strip darts, like taking off bits of clothes for points and darts. Which the keep isn't too, like, thrilled, but these boys are his customers, it's like family. We're all real drunk, and playing strip darts.
I get the picture. Sounds like a real nice picture.
Except when I got a little smarter later, I learned you never, in a neighborhood bar, you don't ever mess with a local guy with a girl and make him look small in front of the girl and then stay there when it happened if he leaves, because it's this kind of guy always comes back.
You learn to leave.
Because this guy, like a half hour later on, he comes back packing. Packing means there's an item involved now, see?
Item?
A gun. This wasn't a big one, I'm remembering a 25 somewhat, in that range. But then he comes, and comes straight over to the dart game, and the girl that's down to a slip pulls it out, and without saying nothing, up and comes right over and shoots our boy. That taking his girl and made him look small, shoots him right in the head, right in the back of the head.
Boy was crazy as a shithouse rat.
Well, Joel, he got made small in front of his girl, and we stayed. And he came back and plugged him in the back of the head.
And killed him dead.
Not right away, he didn't die. The negativist part for me is what we do. All us guys with the guy that was shot. We were all very fucked up by this point in time. I remember it not seeming real. The keep's busy calling the finest. The guy drops the item, and the keep grabbed him, and covered him with the bar piece, and called the finest and kept the guy back behind a bar. I think mostly to keep us from eliminating his map right there, at a payback. We're all blotto zombie drunk by this juncture. The girl, there was blood all down the side of a slip, and here our boy shot in the head. And the guy shot him right through the back of the head from the side, and blood's all over. He always made me think of individuals bleeding in this one way, like steady. But your serious bleeding comes with a pulse, if you don't know. It, like, shoots out, and dies down, and shoots out.
Don't have to tell me.
Well, I don't know you, Joel, am I right? I don't know what you've seen, or know.
I saw an old boy cut his hand off with a chainsaw cutting back brush back at the Cumberland when I was fishing with my daddy. Like to have bled to death right there. My daddy had to use his belt. Before he got it tied off, the blood came like that, with the pulse. My daddy got into the hospital in his car. Like to saved his life. He'd had some training. He could save lives like that.
I tell you, what still gets me is we was so drunk we didn't even somehow take it seriously because everything seemed like a movie when I got real drunk. I still wish we'd thought to take him to the hospital right away. We could have piled him in. He wasn't dead yet, even though he didn't look good. We didn't even lay him down. We got this idea. One of the guys started walking him around. We all walked him around in circles like some kind of OD. Thought if we could keep him walking till the wagon came, he'd be okay. By the end, we was dragging him. I think Danny was dead. Blood all over everybody. The gun wasn't no more than an old 25. People was yelling at us to pile him in and take him to the hospital. But we got this walking him around idea in our heads, to hold him up and walk him in circles, The girl screaming and trying to put her stockings on? And we're yelling at the guy that shot him? How we were going to off with his map and so on and so forth? Till the keep called an ambulance, and they came, and he was dead as a stick.
Gately, that's really bad.
Why are you even up? Don't have to work.
I like it when it snows real early like this. This is the best window. But you learned a lesson.
His name was Chuck, or Chick. The one that got shot that time.
Did you hear that McDade person at supper? You know how some folks have one of their legs shorter than the other?
I don't listen to those guys' crap.
It was down at the far end of the table at supper. He was telling Ken and me how he had a counselor when he was in juvenile in Jamaica Plain. He had this counselor, he said. She had this condition where each leg was shorter than the other.
I don't think I follow you, Joel.
Each of the woman's legs was shorter than the other.
How can a leg that's shorter than the other leg have the other leg shorter than it?
He was having us on. He said the point was an AA point, that it defied sense and explaining, and you just had to accept it on faith. That creepy Randy guy with the white wig was backing him up with a very straight face. McDade said she walked like a metronome. He was making fun of us, but I still thought it was funny.
Maybe tell me about this veil of yours then, Joel, if we're talking about defied sense.
Way out to one side, then way out to the other side.
Really? Let's really interface if you're here then. How come with the veil?
Bridal thing. Aspiring Muslim?
I don't mean to pry in. You can just tell me if you don't want to talk about the veil.
I'm also in another fellowship with almost 4 years in.
UHID.
It's the union of the hideously and improbably deformed. The veil is a sort of fellowship comparison.
What's it compared to?
We all wear one. Almost all of us, with some time in.
But if you don't mind, how come you're in it? UHID? How are you supposed to be deformed? It's nothing that sticks way out, if I can say it. Are you, like, missing something?
There's a brief ceremony. It's a bit like giving out chips over at the Better Late Than Never meeting, for varying lengths. The new UHID stand and receive the veil, and don the veil, and stand there, and recite that the veil they've donned is a type and a symbol, and that they are choosing freely to be bound to wear it always, a day at a time, both in light and darkness, both in solitude and before others' gaze, and as with strangers, so with familiar friends, even daddies, that no mortal eye will see it withdrawn, that they hereby declare openly that they wish to hide from all sight, unquote. I've also got a membership card that spells out everything you could ever want to know, and more.
Except I've asked Pat and Tommy S., and still the thing I don't get is why join a fellowship just to hide. I can see if somebody's like, you know, hideously, and they've been hiding away in the dark all their life, and they want to come in and join a fellowship where everybody's equal and everybody can identify because they all spent their whole life hiding also. And you join a fellowship so you can step out of the dark and into the group and get support and finally show yourself minus eyes or with three arms or whatever and be accepted by people that know just what it's like. And like in AA, they say they'll love you till you can, like, love yourself and accept yourself so you don't care what people see or think anymore. And you can finally step out of the cage and quit hiding.
That's AA?
Kinda. A little bit, I think.
Well, Mr. Gately, what people don't get about being hideously or improbably deformed is that the urge to hide is offset by a gigantic sense of shame about your urge to hide. You're at a graduate wine-tasting party, and improbably deformed. And you're the object of stares that the people try to conceal because they're ashamed of wanting to stare. And you want nothing more than to hide from the covert stares, to erase your difference, to crawl under the tablecloth or put your face under your arm. Or you pray for a power failure, and for this kind of utter, liberating, equalizing darkness to descend, so you can be reduced to nothing but a voice among other voices. Invisible, equal, no different, hidden.
Is this like this thing they talked about people hating their faces on video phones?
But Don, you're still a human being. You still want to live. You crave connection in society. You know intellectually that you're no less worthy of connection and society than anyone else simply because of how you appear. You know that hiding yourself away out of fear of gazes is really giving in to a shame that is not required, and that will keep you from the kind of life you deserve as much as the next girl. You know that you can't help how you look, but that you are supposed to be able to help how much you care about how you look. You're supposed to be strong enough to exert some control over how much you want to hide, and you're so desperate to feel some kind of control that you settle for the appearance of control.
Your voice gets different when you talk about this shit.
What you do is you hide your deep need to hide, and you do this out of the need to appear to other people, as if you have the strength not to care how you appear to others. You stick your hideous face right in there, into the wine-tasting crowd's visual meat grinder. You smile so wide it hurts, and put out your hand, and are extra gregarious and outgoing, and exert yourself to appear totally unaware of the facial struggles of people who are trying not to wince, or stare, or give away the fact that they can see that you're hideously, improbably deformed. You feign acceptance of your deformity. You take your desire to hide and conceal it under a mask of acceptance.
Use less words.
In other words, you hide your hiding, and you do this out of shame, Don. You're ashamed of the fact that you want to hide from sight. You're ashamed of your uncontrolled craving for shadow. UHID's first step is admission of powerlessness over the need to hide. UHID allows members to be open about their essential need for concealment. In other words, we don the veil. We don the veil, and wear the veil proudly, and stand very straight and walk briskly whenever we wish, veiled and hidden, and but now completely upfront and unashamed about the fact that how we appear to others affects us deeply, about the fact that we want to be shielded from all sight. UHID supports us in our decision to hide, openly.
You seem to like drift in and out of different ways of talking. Sometimes it's like you don't want me to follow.
Well, I've got a brand new life, just out of the wrapper, which you all say'll take some time to fit.
So they teach you how to accept your non-acceptance, the union, you're saying.
You followed very well. You didn't need fewer words at all. If you don't mind my saying so, my sense is, you think you're not bright, but you're not.
Not bright?
I put that poorly. You're not not bright, as in you're incorrect in thinking you have nothing upstairs.
It's a self-esteem issue, then, you're seeing in me, after like 3 days here, then. I feel low self-esteem about how I think I'm not bright enough for some people.
Which is fine, UHID would say, to illustrate the UHID take versus an apparently more AA take. UHID'd say it's fine to feel inadequate and ashamed because you're not as bright as some others, but that the cycle becomes annular and insidious if you begin to be ashamed of the fact that being unbright shames you, if you try to hide the fact that you feel mentally inadequate, and so go around making jokes about your own dullness, and acting as if it didn't bother you at all, pretending you didn't care whether others perceived you as unbright or not.
This makes the front of my head hurt, trying to follow this.
Well, you've been up all night.
Then now I have to go to my other fucking job.
You're way brighter than you think, Don G. Although I doubt anything anyone else says can get in there. Into the gnawed, ragged place where you're afraid you're slow and dull.
And what makes you think I think I'm not bright? Unless it's you're saying it's obvious to anybody I'm not bright.
I didn't mean to pry. Just tell me if you don't want to speak to someone you barely know about it.
Now you're being sarcastic in what I said before. I got kicked off of football my 10th grade year for flunking English.
You played American football?
I was good till I got kicked off. They gave me a tutor, and I still flunked.
I used to twirl a baton at halftimes. I went to a special camp, 6 summers running. But a lot of the forms of self-hatred there is no veil for. UHID's taught a lot of us to be grateful that there's at least a veil for our form.
So the veil's a way to not hide it.
To hide openly is more like it. I'm already seeing it's very different from the drug recovery agenda, the AA and NA program.
Can I ask how you're deformed?
The best is when the sun's coming up right through the snow, and everything looks so white. I almost forgot why I came on in. That Kate girl said Ken E. liked to get killed by some son of a bitch last night at that Waltham NA thing. And they want somebody to tell Jeanette not to make them go back again, if they don't want.
One is Kate and Ken can talk for themselves with Jeanette. And I don't need to pry in. And you sure don't need to pry in and rescue nobody else. Two is you're all of a sudden talking different again. And when you're talking about the veil, you didn't sound like you to me. And three is don't think I can't see you coming out sideways all over the place about when I asked... Can I ask what deformity you're not hiding? The fact that you're hiding under that thing. The staff part of me wants to say, if you don't want to answer it, just say so. But don't try and go around the side and think you can distract me into forgetting I asked it.
The UHID in me would say you're trapped in the shame about the shame in response. And that the shame circle keeps you from really being present for your staff job, Don. You're more bugged by the possibility that I'm treating you as unbright and distractible than you are about a resident's inability to come right out and openly exercise her right to refuse to answer an incredibly private and drug-unrelated question.
And now she's back to talking like a fucking English teacher again. But ignore that. That's not the point. Look at how you're trying to get our dialogue all distracted up in shame... And me, again, instead of saying yes or no to me asking, will you tell me what you're missing behind that veil?
Oh, you're good at hiding, Mr. G. You're good. The minute we start to poke at any inadequacies you're ashamed of, see, you drop behind your own protective mask of house staff and start probing areas that you now know I can't bring myself to be open about. Since you got me to tell you all about UHID's philosophy of hiding, so that your own sense of inadequacy gets either buried or used as a backlight to illuminate my own inability to be open and straightforward. The best defense is a good offense, isn't it, Mr. Football Player?
Aspirin time now with all the words. You win. Go watch the snow come down someplace else.
The thing is, Mr. Staff, I've already just completely opened up about my shame and my inability to be open and straightforward about this. You're exposing something I've already held up to view. It's your shame about being ashamed of what you're afraid might be seen as a lack of brightness that's getting to stay buried under this dead horse of my deformity that you're trying to whip.
And then meantime, you still don't say a straight on yes or no. Two, can I ask what's up behind there? Are you cross-eyed or have like a beard or do you have like really bad skin under there? Even though your skin every place that isn't hidden looks...
Looks what? My unhidden skin is what?
See? This is you keep trying to sidetrack instead of just saying no to can I ask. Just say no. Try it. It's okay. Nothing bad will happen. Just try it straight out.
Perfect. You were going to say every visible expanse of my skin is just drop-dead creamy. Perfect.
Jesus, why am I even here? Why don't you just interface with yourself if you think you know all my issues and shames and everything I'm going to say? Why not take the suggestion to say no? Why come in here? Did I come to you to talk? Was I just sitting in here trying to keep awake and do the log and getting ready to go mop shit with a shoe freak? And did or did not you waltz on in and sit down and come to me?
Don, I'm perfect. I'm so beautiful I drive anybody with a nervous system out of their fucking mind. Once they've seen me, they can't think of anything else. And don't want to look at anything else. And stop carrying out normal responsibilities. And believe that if they can only have me right there with them at all times, everything will be all right. Everything. Like I'm the solution to their deep, slavering need to be jowl to cheek with perfection.
Now with the sarcasm.
I am so beautiful. I am deformed.
Now with the non-respectful acting out of treating me like I'm stupid, but trying to get her to walk through her fear to give a straight-out no, which she isn't willing.
I am deformed with beauty.
You want to see my professional staff face? Here's my staff face. I nod and smile. I treat you like somebody I have to humor by nodding and smiling. And behind the face, I'm going with my finger round and round my temple like, what a fucking yutz, like, where's the net?
Believe what you want. I'm powerless over what you believe, I know.
See the professional staffer writing in the meds log? 6 extra strong kind aspirin for staff after sarcasm and sideways refusal to walk through fears and sarcastic acting out by newcomer who thinks she knows everybody else's issues.
What position did you play?
That the staffer wonders how come she's even here in treatment then, if she knows so much. It is starting to get quietly around Ennett House that Randy Lentz has found his own dark way to deal with the well-known rage and powerlessness issues that beset the drug addict in his first few months of abstinence. The nightly AA or NA meetings get out at 2130 hours or 2200 hours, and curfew isn't until 2330, and every Ennett resident mostly carpools back to the house with whatever residents have cars, or some of them go out in cars for massive doses of ice cream and coffee. Lance is one of the ones with the car, a heavily modified old Duster, white with what looked like 12-gauge blasts of rust over the wheel wells, with oversized rear tires and an engine so bored out for heavy breathing speed, it's a small miracle he still has a license. Lance sets Loafer 1 outside Ennett House only after sunset, and then only in his white toupee and mustache and billowing tall-collared topcoat, and goes only to the required nightly meetings. And the thing is that he'll never drive his own car to the meetings. He always thumbs along with somebody else and adds to the crowd in their car. And then he always has to sit in the northernmost seat in the car for some reason, using a compass and napkin to plot out what the night's major direction of travel will be, and then figuring out what seat he'll have to be in to stay maximally north. Both Gately and Jeanette Fultz have had to make a nightly routine of telling the other residents that Lentz is teaching them valuable patience and tolerance. But then after the meeting lets out, Lentz never thumbs back with anybody. He always walks back to the house after meetings. He says it's that he needs the air. What with being shut up in the crowded house all day and avoiding doors and windows, hiding from both sides of the justice system. And then one Wednesday, after the Brookline Young People's AA, up Beacon by Chestnut Hill, it takes him right up to 23:29 to get home. Almost 2 hours. Even though it's like a half-hour walk. And even Bert Smith did it in September in under an hour.
and Lentz gets back just at curfew, and without saying a word to anybody, books it right up to his and Glynn's and Day's room. Polo topcoat flapping, and powdered wig, shedding powder, and sweating, and making an unacceptable, classy-shoed racket, running up the men's side's carpetless stairs, which Gately didn't have time to go up and address, because of having to deal with Bruce Green and Amy Jay, separately both missing curfew. Lentz abroad in the urban night, solo, on almost a nightly basis, sometimes carrying a book. Residents who seem to make it a point to go off alone a lot are red-flagged at Thursday's all-staff meeting in Pat's office as clear relapse risks. But they've pulled spot urines on Lentz 5 times. And the 3 times the lab didn't fuck up the EMIT test, Lentz's urines come back clean. Gately's basically decided to just let Lentz be. Some newcomers' higher power is like nature, the sky, the stars, the cold penny tang of the autumn air. Who knows? So Lentz abroad in the night, unaccompanied and disguised, apparently strolling. He's mastered the streets, cockeyed grid around Enfield, Brighton, Alston, South Cambridge and East Newton and North Brookline and the hideous spur. He takes side streets home from meetings, mostly. Low-rent dumpster-strewn residential streets and projects driveways that become alleys. Gritty passages behind stores and dumpsters and warehouses and loading docks and Empire Waste displacements, Mongo hangars, etc. His loafers have a wicked shine and make an elegant, dancerly click as he walks along with his hands in his pockets, an open coat flared wide, scanning. He scans for several nights before he even becomes aware of why or what he might be scanning for. He moves nightly through urban animal territory. Liberated house cats and hardcore strays ooze in and out of shadows, rustle in dumpsters, fuck and fight with hellish noises all around him as he walks, senses very sharp in the downscale night. You got your rats, your mice, your stray dogs with tongues hanging and countable ribs. Maybe the odd feral hamster and or raccoon. Everything slinky and furtive after sunset. Also, non-stray dogs that clank their chains or bay or lunge when he goes by yards with dogs. He prefers to move north, but will move east or west on the street's good sides. His shoes, fine click, precedes him by several 100 meters on cement of varying texture. Sometimes near drainage pipes he sees serious rats, or sometimes near cat-free dumpsters. The first conscious thing he did was a rat, that this one time he came on some rats in a wide west-east alley by the loading dock out behind the Svelte Nail Company, just east of Watertown on North Harvard Street. What night was that? It'd been coming back from East Watertown, which meant more will be revealed, N.A., with Glynn and Deal, and said of St. E.'s Better Late Than Never, A.A., with the rest of the houses heard. So, a Monday. So, on a Monday, he'd been strolling through this one alley, his steps echoing, trebled back off the cement signs of the docks and the north left wall he hugged, scanning without knowing what he was scanning for. Up ahead there was the stegosaurus shape of a Svelte Company dumpster, as versus your lower, slimmer EWD-type dumpster. There were dry, skulky sounds issuing from the dumpster's shadow. He hadn't consciously picked anything up. The alley's surface was coming apart, and Lentz barely broke his dancerly stride picking a kilo-sized chunk of tar-shot concrete. It was rats. 2 big rats were going at a half-eaten wiener in a mustardy paper tray from a lunch wagon in a recess between the north wall and the dumpster's barge hitch. Their hideous pink tails were poking out into the alley's dim light. They didn't move as Randy Lentz came up behind them on the toes of his loafers. Their tails were meaty and bald and like twitched back and forth, twitching in and out of the dim yellow light. The big flat-top chunk came down on most of one rat and a bit of the other rat. There'd been god-awful twittering squeaks, but the major hit on the one rat also made a very solid and significant noise, some aural combination of a tomato thrown at a wall and a pocket watch getting clocked with a hammer. Material came out of the rat's anus. The rat lay on its side in a very bad medical way, its tail twitching, and anus material, and there were little beads of blood on its whiskers that looked black, the beads, in the sodium security lights along the Svelte Nail Company roof. Its side heaved. Its back legs were moving like it was running, but this rat wasn't going anywhere. The other rat had vanished under the dumpster, dragging its rear region. There were more chunks of dismantled street, lying all over. When Lance brought another down on the head of the rat, he consciously discovered what he liked to say at the moment of issue resolution was, "There." Demapping rats became Lance's way of resolving internal-type issues for the first couple weeks of it, walking home in the verminal dark. Don Gately, house chef and shopper, buys these huge, econo-sized boxes of hefty bags that get stored under the kitchen sink for whoever's got trash for their weekly chore. And it house generates serious waste. So after vermin started to get a little ho-hum and insignificant, Lance starts cabbaging a hefty bag out from under the sink and taking it with him to meetings and walking back home with it. He keeps a trash bag neatly folded in an inside pocket of his topcoat, a billowing top-collared Lauren Polo model he loves, and uses a daily lint roller on. He also takes along a little of the house's food bank tuna fish in a Ziploc baggie in another pocket, which your average drug addict has expertise in rolling baggies into a cylinder so they're secure and odor-free. The Ennett House residents called hefty bags Irish luggage, even McDade. It's a street term. Randy Lentz found that if he could get an urban cat up close enough with some outstretched tuna, he could pop the hefty bag over it and scoop up from the bottom, so the cat was in the air in the bottom of the bag, and then he could tie the bag shut with the complimentary wire twist tie that comes with each bag. He could put the closed bag down next to the vicinity's northernmost wall or fence or dumpster, and light a gasper, and hunker down up next to the wall, to watch the wide variety of changing shapes the bag would assume as the agitated cat got lower on air. The shapes got more and more violent and twisted in mid-air with the passage of a minute. After it stopped assuming shapes, Lentz would dab his butt with a spitty finger to save the rest for later, and get up and untie the twist tie and look inside the bag and go, "There." The "there" turned out to be crucial for the sense of brisance and closure, and resolving issues of impotent rage and powerless fear that, like, accrued in Lentz all day being trapped in the northeastern portions of a squalid halfway house, all day fearing for his life, Lentz felt. There evolved for Lentz a certain sportsman's hierarchy of types of cats, and neighborhoods of types of your abroad cats. And he becomes a connoisseur of cats the same way a deep-sea sportsman knows the fish species that fight most fiercely and excitingly for their marine lives. The best and most fiercely alive cats could usually claw their way out of a hefty bag, though, which created this conundrum where the ones most worth watching, assuming bag shapes, were the ones Lentz risked maybe not getting his issues resolved on. Watching a spike-furred, hissing cat run twisting away, still half-wrapped in a plastic bag, made Lentz admire the cat's fighting spirit, but still feel unresolved. So the next stage is, Lentz gives Ms. Charlotte Treat or Ms. Hester Thrall some of his own dollars when they go down to the Palace Spa or Father-Son to buy smokes or lifesavers, and has them start to get him special hefty steel sack trash bags. Fiber reinforced for your especially sharp or uncooperative waste needs, described by Ken E. as Irish Gucci's. Extra resilient,
and a businesslike gunmetal gray in tone. Lance has such a panoply of strange compulsive habits that a request for steel sacks barely raises a brow on anybody. And then he doubles them, the special reinforced bags, and employs industrial-growth pipe cleaners as twist ties. And then, now, the grittiest, most salutary cats make the doubled bags assume all manners of wickedly abstract twisting shapes, even sometimes moving the closed bags a couple dozen meters down the alley in a haphazard hopping-like fashion, until finally the cat runs out of gas and resolves itself and lends his issues into one nightly shape. Lentz's interval of choice for this is the interval 22-16 hours to 22-26 hours. He doesn't consciously know why, this interval. Anchovies turn out to be even more effective than tuna. "A program of attraction," he recalls coolly, strolling along. His northern routes back to the house are restricted by the priority to keep Brighton Best Savings Bank's rooftop digital time and temperature display in view as much as possible. BBSB displays both EST and Greenwich Mean, which Lance approves of. The liquid crystal data sort of melts upward into view on the screen and then disappears from the bottom up and is replaced by new data. Mr. Dooney R. Glynn said at the house's community meeting Monday once that one time in B.S. 1989 A.D., after he'd done a reckless amount of a hallucinogen he'd refer to only as the Madam, he'd gone around for several subsequent weeks under a Boston sky that, instead of a kindly curved blue dome with your clouds and your stars and sun, was a flat, square, coldly Euclidean grid with black axes and a thread-fine réseau of lines creating grid-type coordinates, the whole grid the same color as a DEC HD viewer screen when the viewer's off. That sort of dead, deep-water gray-green, with the Dow ticker running up one side of the grid and the Nikkei index running down the other, and the time and Celsius temp, to like serious decimal points, flashing along the bottom axis of the sky screen. And whenever he'd go to a real clock, or get a herald and check the, like, Dow, the sky grid would turn out to have been totally accurate, and that several unbroken weeks of this sky overhead had sent Glynn off first to his mother's Stoneham Apartments fold-out couch, and then into Waltham's Metropolitan State Hospital for a month of Haldol and tapioca. To get out from under the empty grid accurate sky, and says it makes his ass wet to this day to even think about the grid interval. But Lentz had thought it sounded wicked nice, the sky as digital timepiece. And also between 22:16 and 22:26, the ATH SCME giant fans off up at the Sunstrand Plaza with an earshot were typically shut off for daily delinting, and it was quiet except for the big shh of the whole urban city's vehicular traffic, and maybe the odd EWD airborne deliverer catapulted up off concavityward, its little string of lights arcing northeast, and, of course, also sirens, both the Euro-trochaic sirens of ambulances and the regular U.S.-sounding sirens of the city's very finest, protecting and serving, keeping the citizenry at bay. And the winsome thing about sirens in the urban night is that unless they're right up close where the lights bathe you in red, blue, red, they always sound like they're terribly, achingly far away and receding, calling to you across an expanding gap. Either that, or they're on your ass. No middle distance with sirens, Lentz reflects, walking along and scanning. Glynn hadn't come right out and said Euclidean, but Lentz had gotten the picture all right. Glynn had thin hair and an invariant 3-day growth of gray stubble and diverticulitis that made him stoop somewhat over, and remaining physique-type issues from a load of bricks falling on his head from a workers' comp scam gone wry that included crossed eyes that Lentz overheard the veiled girl, Joe L., tell Clannette Henderson and Dee Dee Neves the man was so cross-eyed
he could stand in the middle of the week and see both Sundays. Lance had gotten high on organic cocaine two or three, maybe half a dozen times tops, secretly, since he came into Ennett House in the summer. Just enough times to keep him from going totally out of his fucking mind, utilizing lines from the private emergency stash he kept in a kind of rectangular bunker, razor-bladed out of 300 or so pages of Bill James's gargantuan, large print, Principles of Psychology and the Gifford Lecture on Natural Religion. Such totally occasional substance ingestions in a rundown, sloppy-clocked house, where he's cooped up and under terrible stress all day, every day, hiding from threats from two different legal directions, with, upstairs at all times, calling to him, a 20-gram stash from the underreported South End two-way attempted scam, whose very bad luck had forced him into hiding in squalor and rooming with the likes of fucking Jeffrey D. Cocaine ingestion this occasional and last resort is such a marked reduction of use and abuse for Lentz that it's a bona fide miracle and clearly constitutes as much miraculous sobriety as total abstinence would be for another person without Lentz's unique sensitivities and psychological makeup and fucking intolerable daily stresses and difficulty unwinding. And he accepts his monthly chips with a clear conscience and a head unmuddled by doubting. He knows he's sober. He's smart about it. He's never ingested cocaine on his solo walks home from meetings, which is where the staff had expect him to ingest, if he was going to ingest, and never in Ennett House itself, and only once in the forbidden number 7 across the roadlet. And anybody with half a clue can beat an emit urine screen. A cup of lemon juice or vinegar down the hatch will turn the lab's reading into gibberish. A trace of powdered bleach on the fingertips, and let the stream play warmly over the fingertips on its way into the cup, while you banter with Don G. A Texas catheter is a pain to get piss for and put on, plus the obscene size of the thing's receptacle for his unit gives Lance inadequacy issues, and he's only used it twice, both times when Jeanette F. took the urine, and he could embarrass her into turning away. Lance owns a Texas Cathy from his last halfway house in Quincy, in what Lance recalls as the year of the Maytag Quiet Master. And then, it turned out, when a cat aggrieved Lance by scratching his wrist in a particularly hostile fashion on the way into the receptacle, that doubled, hefty steel sacks were such quality-reinforced products they could hold something razor-clawed and frantically in motion and still survive a direct swung hit against a no-parking sign or a telephone pole without splitting open, even when what was inside split nicely open. And so that technique got substituted around United Nations Day because, even though it was too quick and less meditative, it allowed Randy Lentz to take a more active role in the process, and the feeling of temporary, nightly, issues resolution was more definitive, when Lance could swing a twisting 10-kilo burden hard against a pole and go, there, and hear a sound. On banner nights, the doubled bag would continue for a brief period of time, to undergo a subtle flux of smaller, more subtle, and connoisseur-oriented shapes, even after the melony sound of hard impact, along with further, smaller sounds. Then it was discovered that resolving them directly inside the yards and porches of the people that owned them provided more adrenal excitation and thus more sense of what Bill James one time called a catharsis of resolving, which Lance felt he could agree. A small can of oil in its own little baggie for squeaky gates. But because steel sack trash bags, and then also tuna fish mixed with anchovies and Raid ant poison from behind the Ennett residence fridge, caused too much resultant noise to allow for lighting a gasper and hunkering down to meditatively watch, Lentz developed the habit of setting the resolution in motion and then booking on out of the yard into the urban night, his polo topcoat billowing, hurtling fences and running over the hoods of cars, etc. For a period during the two-week interval of give them poison tuna and run, Lentz had brief recourse to a small Caldor brand squeeze bottle of kerosene, plus, of course, his lighter. But a Wednesday night, on which the alight cat ran, as a light cat's will, like hell, but ran after Lentz, seemingly, leaping the same fence as Lentz hurtled, and staying on his tail, and not only making an unacceptable attention-calling racket, but also illuminating Lentz to the scopophobic view of passing homes, until it finally decided to drop to the ground and expire and smolder thereupon. Lentz considered this his only really close call, and took an enormous, and partly non-north, route home, with every siren sounding up close, and on his personal ass, and barely got in by 23:30 hours, and ran right up to the three-man room. This was the night Lentz had to have another recourse, to the hollowed-out cavity in his Principles of Psychology and the Gifford Lecture on Natural Religion, after just beating curfew home, which, who wouldn't need a bit of an unwinder after a stressful, close-call-type situation with a flaming cat chasing you, and screaming in a way that made porch lights go on all up and down Sumner Blake Road, except, but instead of an unwinder, the couple or few lines of uncut Bing proved to be, on this occasion, an un-unwinder. Which happens sometimes, depending on one's, like, spiritual condition when ingesting it through a rolled dollar bill off the back of the John in the men's can. And Lentz barely made it through switching his car's parking spot at 23:50 hours before the verbal torrent started, and after lights out, had only gotten up to age 8 in the oral autobiography that followed in The Three Men, when Jeff D. threatened to go get Don G. and have Lentz forcibly stifled, and Lentz was scared to go downstairs to find somebody to listen, and so, for the rest of the night, he had to lie there in the dark, mute, with his mouth twisting and writhing. It always twisted and writhed on the times the Bing proved to be a rev upper instead of a rough edge smoother. And pretending to be asleep, with phosphenes like leaping flaming shapes dancing behind his quivering lids, listening to Day's moist gurgles and Glenn's apnea, and thinking that each siren abroad, out there in the urban city, was meant for him and coming closer. With Day's illuminated watch face in his fucking tableside drawer, instead of out, where anybody with some stress and anxiety could check the time from time to time. So after the incident with the flaming cat from hell, and before Halloween, Lentz had moved on and up to the Browning X 444 serrated. He even had a shoulder.